You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Pink Fu has not only helped develop the web browser Mosaic and advise President Obama on innovation and entrepreneurship, she's also the founder and CEO of Geomagic, a leading 3D digital reality solution company. But before all of this, from the ages of 8 to 18, she endured the Chinese Cultural Revolution as a political prisoner, factory worker, and sexual abuse victim. Ms. Fu talks about her journey from the troubles of her youth in China to the frontier of technology innovation in America in her memoir, Bend, Not Break. It's published by Portfolio, Penguin Portfolio. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What part of China were you born in?
I was born in Nanjing, a city south of Shanghai.
Uh-huh. Famous in most people's minds because of the terrible things that happened during World War II.
That's right.
And is that where you spent your childhood years?
No, I was sent to Shanghai on 11th day after I was born in Nanjing to be raised by my aunt and uncle.
And was there a reason for that? Did you know at the time why you'd been sent, taken from your parents and sent to your aunt and uncle?
My mom is a working woman and she didn't want children. Mm-hmm. So my aunt picked me up and raised me.
And Shanghai, was it still considered the Paris of the East in 1966?
Yes, I think it has always been considered as the Paris of the East.
Uh-huh. Well, Shanghai was a... as an odd city, it almost felt for a while like it's out of the loop. How fast did Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution reforms reach Shanghai?
Immediately. Shanghai was the target because the Gang of Four, who's responsible for a lot of propaganda and atrocity of China, was in Shanghai.
Mm-hmm. And Shanghai was seen as the most westernized city, probably the one that needed to be cleansed the most.
That's correct.
Let's talk about your title for a moment. It refers to part of the Three Friends of Winter. The book is called Bend, Not Break, based on the quality of bamboo. Why did you pick bamboo instead of the other friends of winter, plum blossom and the pine tree?
My Shanghai papa said I need to be bamboo, as if he knew atrocity was awaiting for me.
Mm-hmm. So you had to learn to bend without breaking.
Yes.
And is that something that stayed in your mind throughout your childhood?
It was. I thought my Shanghai papa was very wise to pick the bamboo because he knew that I would be killed if I stand too straight.
Well, then the Red Guards took you from that Shanghai home and put you alone on a train back to Nanjing. You were just 9 years old.
I was 8, and I arrived in Nanjing just a little bit too late when my biological parents were sent to exile.
And why were they sent to exile? Were you one of those people who had to deal with the fact that your parents and their families had been merchants or had some wealth before the revolution?
Yeah, my mom come from an entrepreneur family, and my dad is educated. He was a professor, so both of them were targets.
And I would assume that also would have applied to your Shanghai family.
Yes, Shanghai papa was from a banking family. Shanghai mama was stay home, so she did not get to send to exile.
So here you are in Nanjing. Your parents are sent off into exile. Who did you live with?
I was lived by myself and with my little sister. She was 4 years old.
And you were sent, you just lived in a school dormitory?
Yeah, they put us into the emptied university dormitory, which is kind of a ghetto for all the black elements kid.
Sometimes you found little surprises at your door. What were they?
We didn't have any food, and sometimes I find food left out of the door for us.
Did you ever find out who gave you that extra food?
One of the person who were giving us food was our neighbor's son, and I only found out after Cultural Revolution was over
when he couldn't admit to it. Obviously, right. He would have gotten in trouble.
They would, yeah. They have to risk their life to do that.
So can you describe your daily routine while you were living in this student dormitory?
At the beginning, it was a lot of chaos. We were put into bitter meal sessions or denunciation sessions to go on stage, condemn ourselves and our families. We were being...
But you were 8 or 9 years old. How much could you even know about your family?
I didn't. I just mimic what other people do and try to not get in trouble, otherwise they hit me.
And then at 10, you were sent to work in a factory?
I started a factory pretty early, I think even at 8, soon after, a few months after.
Were you getting any schooling during this time?
Not the official, not the academic study. I did learn a lot by doing things.
Well, what kinds of factories were you working in?
I was, when I was 8, I was there peeling plastic covers, just separating them. And then I started building radios around 10.
So do you think that that experience, as awful as it was working in a factory at 10, is the source of your interest in technology?
I think that's certainly was the unconsciousness behind my mind to start Geomagic in the manufacturing sector, and combine technology with manufacturing has a lot to do with that experience.
Now, you're 10 years old working in a factory. Were you alone, or were there other kids who were in the same situation?
There were hundreds of black kids in our sector.
Black kids because your names were blackened?
No, we were told our blood was blackened.
Uh-huh.
We had a black lineage, so we were born with black blood.
Well, even though when you cut yourself, it turned out to be red.
Right. But
which is the color of the Communist Party. How did they explain that? There was a man named Wang. He was really important to your life at that time.
Yes, he was my supervisor at the factory, and he gave me a lot of encouragement and taught me that I can do things that I thought I couldn't do.
So despite the harshness of your life, there were strangers who expressed kindness to you?
Yes. Often I've seen kindness in people, even in my tormentors.
Now, you said you had black blood. Were there certain punishments that people who had black blood automatically received?
Yes, because we were stripped with all rights. We had no rights. We were nobody. We have no rights to go to school. We have no rights to take a decent job. We can't even fall in love with people who has red blood.
And then you were publicly humiliated, weren't you?
I was told to scream out of my lungs that I was nobody. I was gang raped at age of 10. And then being publicly humiliated as a broken shoe. So at 10, I was a ruined woman.
So the Red Guards raped you?
Yes, there were about 10 or 12 Red Guards. They threw my sister into the canal, water canal, and I jumped in to save her. She was saved, but I was not spared.
Now, the Red Guards supposedly were the moral conscience of China at the time. How could they reconcile what they did with that?
At that time, the Red Guards did a lot of things, raping, killing, taking things from people, and it was encouraged. They were told that they were master of the country. They were told that the bourgeois class had deprived them for a better life, so they were allowed to do anything. It's kind of like Nazis.
And you were keeping a journal at the time. That didn't help when they found the journals?
Yeah, my journal was the only friends I had, and I didn't have anybody to talk to, so I wrote the journal on the backside of the communist propaganda and hoping that would not be discovered, but it was discovered when I was 13 and it was burned right in front of me.
My guess is Ping Fu, who has written with Mei Mei Fox a book called Bend Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds, So you developed a sense of shame about your family's wealthy background.
Yes.
Did that? How long did that last?
I think that last almost entire life. I'm getting better now. Sometimes still catching up with me.
Well, you're entrepreneurial and your family have been entrepreneurial. You must see on some level that there may almost be a genetic reason for you being the way you are.
I do believe I was born with good genes and good temperaments. But I do, with that kind of experience, I do have doubts in my head. I have to consciously working on it.
How, well, you could never really recover from the trauma of the kind of situation you received, the sexual abuse. But how long before you were able at least to try to pick up the pieces and try to move on with your life?
So when I was 13 or 14, one of my Uncle W., who I wrote in the book, brought me some Western literature, and I read them at night. I was not caught by reading those literatures. That opened a different world to me. And then when I got older, I started questioning the authorities' message. I started to develop my own independent thinking.
You were admitted to Suzhou University, even though you'd barely received a formal education. How did you get into university if you had black blood?
After Cultural Revolution was over in 1976, China was going to reopen university in 1977. Many of us studied to pass national exam to get into university, mm-hmm. and I did pass the national exam.
And what did you study at the university?
I wanted to be an astronaut, but I was assigned to study Chinese literature. So that's what I studied.
And then you were deported?
Yeah, I...
What had you done?
I was doing my graduation thesis research, and I heard there were baby girls being killed in the countryside due to one-child policy. And I went to study, I went to research that, and I saw hundreds of baby girls being killed right in front of my eyes. I saw girls being tossed into the river when their umbilical cord still fresh. So I wrote the report, and that got caught, that got picked up by Chinese newspaper, then got picked up by international newspaper, and that caused an outcry for human rights violation in China, and I got in trouble.
So were you thinking of yourself as an activist journalist at the time?
No, I was just trying to graduate. But I did care about that issue, and what I saw broke my heart. So I raised the issue to the national consciousness.
It's still a problem in China for people who want to write about things they observe. You can't call yourself a journalist, but you can blog about what you observe and perhaps get in trouble.
That is still true. The freedom of expression is still not quite allowed in China.
So you left China, how old were you?
I was 25 when I left.
Have you ever returned?
I did return in 1993 after I became U.S. citizen.
And you came here knowing how many words of English?
I tried. I only remember three when I landed here, which is hello, thank you, help.
But then you wound up going to the University of New Mexico.
Yeah, they were the one issued me a visa for English as second language. That's my first landing point.
You had to support yourself.
I worked. I cleaned house, worked as waitress, and tried to get through school.
And had you brought any money with you?
No, I was penniless. I only had an $80 traveler's check to buy a transfer ticket from San Francisco to New Mexico. And I told that story in my book. When I got to San Francisco, I was $5 short for the ticket. In China, price never change, and in the United States, price do change, but in this case, it went up. I couldn't buy my ticket, and there was an American man standing behind me, gave the $5 to the counter, And that was my first impression of America. People are generous and warm.
Although you had experienced some generosity in China as well.
That's true.
Ping Fu, founder and CEO of Geomagic Incorporated, has written, with the help of Mei Mei Fox, a memoir called Bend, Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Ping Fu, F-U. She's written with the help of Mei Mei Fox, a memoir called Bend, Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. So you had studied literature, and now in New Mexico, did you continue to study literature, or did you move over to computer programming?
I couldn't study literature because my English was too poor. And I didn't have formal K-12 education, so I didn't know what to study. Somebody told me to check out computer science, which was a new field in early 80s. I asked, what's that? And the person said, it's man-made language that makes stuff. I thought, great, I'm good with language, and I know how to make stuff. That's what I'm going to study. So I ended up studying computer science, which is a great field.
How did you get involved with the Mosaic browser?
I was at National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and I hired this student. His name is Mark Andreessen. And we were doing supercomputing applications. Mark and some other younger programmer came to me with this idea about writing a browser, and I supported them to do that.
And how did the browser work?
At that time, we actually tried to write a browser that help us to manage the public domain software so that we don't have to type in the network address all the time. And it was also hard-coded. And then we found Gopher and WWW from Switzerland, so we decided to make it more smart. And Mark came up with the idea of what's called inline imaging, which is you can click a link and take you to somewhere. And that made browser much more popular.
And it led to some degree to the internet boom, didn't it? It made it a lot easier for people like me to be able to use the internet.
Right. We worked on a lot of internet technology like Telnet, imaging software, and collaboration software. And browser is what made it really popular. In fact, the browser brought down the entire university network one day because 3 million people tried to access our side. At that time, internet couldn't handle that kind of volume. That's when we knew that something really, truly remarkable is in our hand.
There's always the problem of doing something like this and making money from it. You probably were tempted to make it a lot more expensive than it turned out to be.
We give Mosaic out for free because we were a federal center. Everything that we developed was put into the public domain. Mark left the university after graduation to start Netscape with Jim Clark, who was a big sponsor to our center. And I stayed behind, went to Hong Kong to help them to build a mini supercomputing center.
Were there other research teams at the time developing browsers?
There wasn't any other team developing graphic-based browser. We did have licensees, so like Microsoft licensed Mosaic as Internet Explorer.
So you say you went back to China?
I went to Hong Kong.
At that time, still under the control of Britain, or it had already been given back to China?
That was right before Hong Kong went back to China, so they are still not being controlled by export policy, and they can still do supercomputing center in Hong Kong.
Did it feel odd? You were kind of in both worlds.
Yeah, going back to Hong Kong is kind of my way of halfway going back to my roots. I still wasn't comfortable to go back to China, and Hong Kong is a neighbor to China, so it's try to go back to my lineage.
But at this point, you're working within groups, but what led you to become an entrepreneur?
I call myself a reluctant entrepreneur. When I came back from Hong Kong, Netscape went public, university went crazy, and they wanted to find next killer app. So we have a lot of people talking about starting company, but nobody start one. And my boss, Joe Harding, said, I'm so sick of all the talk, no actions. And I raised my hand. I said, I'll start one.
And that's what led to Geomagic?
Yeah, that's what led to Geomagic. When I first went out to start a business, I didn't know what I should do. And it was an internet high. I was wanting to do something that has value. I think it's kind of natural for me to try to combine internet technology, which I was right in the thick of it, with manufacturing, which is how I grew up. I just combined the two and started Geomagic.
On the other, but I would think that you faced all sorts of challenges other people might not face. First of all, much of that field is kind of like a boys' club. And on top of it all, you're also an immigrant. So did that make it harder, or in some ways did it make it easier?
It was hard at the beginning, and I made a fatal mistake because of that. I went to an investment conference, walked in with 1,000 men with black suit, and I felt very out of the place. So my decision was to hire a CEO to help me run the company rather than me running it. And that was more of a woman not having the confidence at the beginning and being an immigrant and don't have the experience. I should have just run it myself, but I didn't know at the time.
Well, your co-founder at Geomagic is your husband, Herbert.
Yes, he decided to stay in the university as a professor right after we started the business.
So he could have joined you in the business, but he didn't?
He didn't want to. He's really a mathematician.
At the time that you started Geomagic, your daughter, Shishi, was only 3. So on top of everything else, you're starting up this company and being the mother of a very young child.
Yeah, at the beginning, I thought I didn't want to start the business because my daughter was too young. Now looking back, I think I'm blessed because I have a daughter. She was the only one could take me away from work. So I didn't eat a lot of French fries and working into the middle of the night because I need to go home.
My guest is Ping Fu, founder and CEO of Geomagic Incorporated. She has written a memoir called Bend, Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds, published by Portfolio Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So doing this has led you into all sorts of other things, consulting with the president, for example. And then when did you decide that you wanted to write a memoir?
I thought about writing it in 2006. Then I stopped because I thought my daughter was too young to deal with that. And I decided to write it when she turned 18, mm-hmm. which is early this year.
So you had more time on your hands. She went off to school, I assume.
Yeah.
And you wrote it with Maymay Fox. Did you talk in Mandarin or in English when you were working on the book?
We talk English. Maymay can speak Mandarin also. She was born in Hong Kong, although she's American.
Was it painful to recall some of the traumatic experiences of your earlier years when you were writing it?
It was painful sometimes. Sometimes I just want to forget it, and it certainly brings back all the memories that I already put away.
Well, many people who've been victims of sexual abuse don't talk about it. They just simply pass over that part of their lives because in many cultures, they wind up becoming the blamed person rather than the abusers. We're seeing that now being played out in India, for example. Did anybody ever give you a hard time about it?
In China, certainly, that's considered to be shameful and considered to be something you would not want to talk about it. In America, I think it's still a little bit taboo to talk about it, but I decided to tell my story.
You describe reading the journals of your grandfather after you took a trip to China in the 90s. Who gave them to you?
My Shanghai Papa gave it to me before he passed away, and he wanted me to see that my blood was red after all.
Now, your Shanghai Papa is not your real father.
Yeah.
He's your uncle who you lived with for a little while?
He's the uncle who raised me from 11 days to 8 years old before I was taken away.
How did reading the journals make you feel about your so-called family history, which gave you black blood?
The journal was very interesting. In the journal, there was an article and actually a newspaper about my grandfather from father and the mother's side married their first children to raise money for local school during Second World War. And I also, it's a journey of their entrepreneurship in China in the 30s. And I didn't know any of those. And they run such a parallel track of my current life. So it's very enlightening to read them.
Well, are you stunned by how much the entrepreneurial spirit is now encouraged in China, considering the fact that 30 years ago you could be sent to prison for doing any of these things?
I'm stunned, and yet at the same time it feels very natural, because I actually end up going back to read a lot of Chinese history, and I realize Chinese people has always been very entrepreneurial.
Well, invented paper and gunpowder and a whole bunch of other things.
That's right.
For a long time, China was probably the most advanced culture on the planet.
That's right.
You wrote another book, didn't you, in 1994 that was published in China before this one? What was that book about?
When I was in Hong Kong, I wrote a book about my first 10 years in the United States and my experience as an immigrant and student.
Is it only published in Hong Kong?
That was published in mainland China.
Didn't you have a tense relationship with the government of authorities at that time?
I did. However, that book was strictly a student and immigrant experience story. There's nothing political, so it was allowed to be published. Also, I think in the early 90s, China just started economic development, and a lot of people want to read that material. It was a material.
Although, were you being honest when you wrote in that book, "I'll never be an entrepreneur because business people hate their jobs and love money. I love my job and hate money"? Did you really think like that?
At that time, I did. That was 2 years before I started my business. That's amazing.
Well, you were kind of embarrassed when you started making real money?
I still struggle with the concept of money, although I think I do now have a different opinion of it. And there is something I've been talking about that's interesting. That is, if you think about communist or socialist or Green Party, they are very proud of their ideology. And capitalist has never been that way. So I think in the 2000s, we have this renaissance movement of social consciousness of business, which is contributed by down market and also the national awareness of inequality in America. I think that's a great movement. If we do believe that we are a capitalist society, why can't we be proud of it?
You're in a field where things change very quickly. Companies become huge billion-dollar businesses and then suddenly are in serious trouble. How do you keep up with everything?
Like anything else, you keep up with life and you keep up with work. You learn from everybody else.
Now, the reason I ask is I've been thinking about Google recently. Apple went from being a troubled company to innovating and suddenly becoming the richest company in the world, I think, right now. Google has a lot of brilliant people working for it, and yet every time it tries to do anything other than be a search engine, it seems to fail. And this is in a business where it seems to me everybody knows what everybody else is doing. So I wonder how that happens.
I think what's being reported in the media or quarterly earning news versus what companies are focusing on doing, or even people within those companies, there's a huge gap. People in the company, a lot of time, they want to do what they love, and they want to innovate. Those things doesn't get reported, right? What's get reported are quarterly earning, or if the stock goes up and down, then the news report try to guess what the reasons are. Most of company needs to just ignore those as a void, as a noise, and focusing on what you are truly good at and focusing on what problem you truly try to solve.
And what problems are you trying to solve these days at Geomagic?
I really try to bring manufacturing back to United States, or just local fabrication, I believe.
You're Chinese and you're bringing manufacturing to the United States as opposed to the Americans who are bringing all the manufacturing to China.
Right. And I think that is lesser of an issue of which country is doing that. It's more of that it's a better for us as a human if product is made for us, next to us, it's better service. It's also greener because less carbon footprint when you do local distributed manufacturing. And culturally, it's also more rich because I don't want to walk into Walmart to see things made in China to be American junk. I'd rather to be made in China as Chinese culture, made in America as American great products. So I want a product to be locally made, distributed, and connected with a global network.
Ping Fu is the founder and CEO of Geomagic, a 3D digital reality solution company. Sharon did an MS in computer science at the University of Illinois, worked at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and AT&T Bell Labs, also is a member of President Obama's National Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and a board member of the Long Now Foundation. Her memoir, Bend, Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds, written with the help of Maymay Fox, is published by Portfolio Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.